You're listening to DottoTech, helping you get the most out of your technology wherever you use it, at home, at school, or at work. Brought to you by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. 20 years, the trusted voice of technology in Canada, Steve Dotto.
Hello and welcome to DottoTech. I am Steve Dotto, and we are ever so glad you are joining us this fine evening. Art Factor, how are you doing, sir?
I am very well. I wish the summer would start.
I don't know. We've messed up the environment so much, the world. It's just get used to summer in November.
Isn't there an app for
it's
that?
It's great. My birthday's in November. I think I'll be very happy to be able to like suntan. Although you can't suntan anymore because that will just lead to dire consequences.
Right.
So how does your comedy shows go last week? Art Factor, of course, stand-up comedian extraordinaire.
I had a fantastic show at the Rio Theater on Saturday.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we had to compete against this guy named Russell Peters.
Yeah, he's not bad.
The entire world.
He does a pretty good job.
So, yeah, he had about 20,000 people at GM Place.
And you had about 20?
We had over 100, but...
Well, that's not bad.
Yeah, we were hoping for more.
Now, is Filipino humor as funny as Indian humor? That's what I want to know.
Funnier and tastier. Not as spicy, though.
I don't know if it's tastier. I'm a big fan of Filipino cooking, but Indian food's pretty darn good, too.
I know how to make my lumpia.
I know how to make my lumpia and my adobo, if you know what I mean.
Look at you. You're just, you got the crap. You know what? I'm giving you the card. You can have the Filipino card.
I can. Thank you so much. That means ever so much to me. We've got a great show lined up today. We're going to be, John Beeler is going to be joining us. He is a photographer, blogger. We're going to be talking about 3D printers and a whole whack of other things with John and Paul DeMere also joining us today. Actually, they're both sitting in the studio right now, so we might as well just get them chatting. And, you know, it's just a week ago now that Microsoft announced their new venture into the tablet computing world. And it's like, we want to be Apple because they're doing everything. They've completely turned... Now, I don't usually talk too much about the business side of technology or try to avoid it because I don't find it nearly as interesting as the technology itself, but I find it fascinating that Microsoft is willing to basically say to their channel, we don't care about you anymore. All of their hardware partners for all those years, they've always just been an OEM developing the software for other people to make the hardware, except for the Xbox. And now all of a sudden they're saying, oh, screw you guys. We're just going to build the darn thing ourselves and we're going to go head-to-head with Apple. What's your take, John?
It's really interesting, but, I mean, they didn't let anybody play with it.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to really form an opinion on something you haven't really had a chance to play with other than them showing you a nice shiny little box, which was designed on a 3D printer, by the way.
Okay, which we will be talking about in a minute, just tying it through. Yeah, there was a very soft, it was very reminiscent of RIM launches of the past where they say, here, look at this piece of technology, it's going to do all these things, don't touch it, don't do anything with it. And actually several journalists commented about the fact that they would try and touch something that would be taken away from them. As they were holding it, but the Surface has been, you know, it certainly did catch everybody's attention, and I think that the community, the thing that surprised me about all of the press that I've seen about it so far, is people are really willing to give Microsoft they're not basically busting their chops, but they're saying, okay, we think this is going to be a good idea. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be an issue. It's going to be relevant, and we think you can do it.
I'm all for competition, and frankly, I think no one's really taken Apple to task in the tablet space, mm-hmm. other than maybe Samsung with the Android stuff. So, you know, bring it. You know, bring some cool stuff. And I have to admit, the keyboard in the case cover thing is kind of clever. Mm-hmm. How useful it's going to be, or how you
that
know,
was gimmicky. At the end of the day, that was a bit gimmicky. Here's the thing. And most people are talking about the Windows RT version, which we don't really know much about Windows RT, but the one that's going to be going
name,
ahead.
Isn't it?
Not really, but it's going to. It's good. Yeah, Microsoft's naming conventions on this will be deeply disturbing once they do it, for sure. But the consumer version, which is designed to go head-to-head with the iPad, that's one story. I'm far more compelled with what they're doing with their full Windows 8 version, which it seems to be everybody else is kind of leaving behind. But what makes it interesting to me is the tablet, is the pen-based interface, because they've got a capacitive pen that they're going to have? So similar to how notebooks in the past would have pen-based, where you could actually rest your hand on the screen and then write, which you can't do with the iPad, which is where I find the iPad the most frustrating, is taking notes. I have to type because you can't handwrite notes and you can't draw. You're going to be able to do that with this Windows 8 tablet. that micro, the Surface tablet, and that is creates some really interesting vertical applications.
I was really skeptical of the reintroduction of the stylus, which Samsung did with the Galaxy Note, until I used it for a while. And it does make sense.
Yeah.
I know lots of artist friends that love it because they can actually do what you just described. They can actually get their hand in there and get the detail and stuff like that. So, again, if it makes sense, great. Let's see what happens when that actually ships.
Yeah, it'll be well. And when that is the that's an off
the million dollar question, right?
That is a huge question. The other company in the news a lot this week, and not necessarily for all good reasons, has been Facebook. They launched a couple of new initiatives. One of them is causing a bit of a furor. I'm not sure if it's a tempest in a pot of tea or not, but they've without permission, and this hasn't happened to me yet, so I actually have only read about it. They've been taking people's email addresses that is in your default profile and switching it from whatever your email address you put in the profile to your Facebook email address as their default. Has it happened to you yet, John?
It did. Yeah, I checked yesterday, and it has switched over. I'm not so worried about that because most people don't use Facebook to get my email anyways, and I'm kind of all over the internet already. But certainly for some people, that could be confusing, and the problem that Facebook has always had with their messaging systems is they have their Facebook messaging, and there's the other section, and I've missed all kinds of important messages from people that I don't necessarily know or don't interact with on a regular basis, and it's been hidden. And so this is kind of like another way of doing that as well.
Yeah.
And so it's just like the whole messaging thing seems to be such a mess with Facebook, and it sounds like they're really just sort of throwing darts at the board to see what sticks.
I saw.
Yeah.
Have you checked yours yet, Paul?
Yeah, I'm just looking at it. It's my actual default that I set it up
it's
as.
Set as.
It's gmail.com.
So it's one of the typical rolling releases. I think the most clever quote that I saw was, I guess Facebook has been posting out some messaging saying the best way to reach your friends is their new Facebook email address. And Mike Vardy from Lifehack posted, no, the best way to reach me is by my email address, not by my Facebook address. I don't check Facebook all that often. And it does. It creates, for most of us, having so many places that people think that they can touch base with you. As you say, John, you miss important messages. The one that I have trouble keeping up on, and I do tend to stay on top of it because I forward it all to my main email address, is the LinkedIn mail. But, there's just another email. But there's so much email that comes in from LinkedIn that quite often I'll miss an important message because it might be just somebody else requesting to be a friend. So I don't always notice or being a contact. I guess you're not friends on LinkedIn. You're a contact. But sometimes I'll miss a message there.
But it might be a moot point if we can forward our Facebook mail to something else important.
Yeah,
right?
Centralize it to one email. That's what I've done. Everything comes into one email, and it's easy for me to keep an eye on that one email. I don't want three or four email addresses. Not a good thing. Too complicated.
Yeah, it's just going to continue to get to be more and more complicated. The other thing that Facebook did this week is they launched and then withdrew very quickly a kind of a Find Friends feature where you could see the physical location of people. And I guess that just opened too big a can of worms for
Big Brother is watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I use Foursquare. I'm happy to use Foursquare, but that's something I have to log in and sign in and do.
You make a decision, right?
Yeah, I make a decision.
And you also get to choose who of your friends can see your login.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the Facebook, that's the security. And the big issue there, of course, is around privacy, but it's also around underage and younger kids using Facebook. And I've been doing a little bit of reading that there's a bit of a movement right now by the Facebook, I guess their advisory council and people in that area that are pushing Facebook to start allowing younger kids to get membership. Right now, if you're not 13, you can't have a Facebook account. That's the law. That's Facebook's
It's their
rules.
Rule, but I have a nephew that was on Facebook well before he was 13.
How did he accomplish that?
The same way anybody does anything. You create a fake account.
Now, did he have his parents' permission to do that, or did he just do it?
I don't think so.
Oh, what's your nephew's name? No, I'm just kidding.
Don't get him in trouble.
Don't get him in trouble, by all means.
Just kidding.
He should be in trouble.
Well, reality is that most kids know more about the computer and Facebook security than the parents do.
So here is the I think, very creative solution, because this is an area that's near and dear to my heart, is the community is pushing Facebook to allow younger kids to legally have an account, to sign up for an account with Facebook, under the guidance of a parent. So it's just like, going to a movie theater, you have to be accompanied by an adult. On Facebook, your parent has to have oversight over your account so they can look at your friends.
It's like a delegate or whatever in email, too. Same concept.
But that creates because they say up to 60% of kids under, you know, between the ages of 10 and 13 now have Facebook accounts in North America. And only a percentage of those, their parents even know about them.
Right.
So this way, it gives you a vehicle for parents to legitimately do it with their kids. Because right now, if parents want to do this, they basically have to break the rules of Facebook, which sets a fairly bad example to your kids. Well, you know, these are the rules that they have in place, and they're there for a good reason, but I know better because I'm your dad. That works once in a while, but I don't think that's the well we want to go back to on a regular basis. So hopefully Facebook is going to be listening, and they're going to change some of those rules. Art, have you got anything to chime in with the underage stuff?
I don't have kids. I've got nieces and nephews. And I don't know. I think the nieces and nephews that I have, I'm glad that they're not the fans of the Miley Cyrus, Britney Spears sort of underage. Because everything I see, it's usually about school. Yeah. They're joking with their friends. But nothing that I would say, I better call your mom or yeah. my brother and tell them what's going on.
Well, it's interesting. I was chatting with my daughter, who's 14, the other day, and when she first got her Facebook account, she got it as soon as she was 13, like 3 days later, she got it. And within 3 or 4 weeks, I saw something on her wall, not written by her, but written by one of the kids that she was friends with, that I found a little bit offensive. And I mentioned it to her, and she said, "Oh, he's not my friend anymore." I said, "Why not?" "Because of what he posted." Mm. So she had already self-filtered, and that for me, that was just a, you know, a big step that said, "Okay, I can trust this kid."
That happened with my niece too. Somebody was posting stuff on her Facebook page, and her dad saw it, and blah blah. Because they're all friends in the family, and we saw it, and it was obviously inappropriate, right? And yeah.
One of the things, though, about the sort of the parental control system that you discussed earlier, it'd be great if by default those underage kids had an extremely locked down profile, so their friends couldn't post arbitrary stuff on their wall. Because I saw that as well, and you know. Kids
it would be very easy to put together a language filter and stuff like that that you needed to, that could do it. They should be looking at that. But, of course, Facebook is only concerned with one thing at this point, and it's not protecting the privacy of anybody. It's making money. And that's what they're...
Bag of money.
They have to pay for Instagram.
Yeah.
$1 billion.
What's with that?
That's money well spent. We're going to take a break because John Buehler's here to talk about 3D printers. Now, if you don't know about 3D printers... We're going to do the best job we can painting the picture of what these things are here on radio, but they are way cool. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Steve Dotto, and you are tuned in to Dotto Tech.
Dotto Tech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. You're listening to Dotto Tech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
Now, John Buehler is well known in the blogosphere. He is a photographer, blogger. He teaches photography, especially. You like teaching photography on the cheap, don't you, John?
I do. I'm cheap. The problem with photography stuff is it's always really expensive, and people want that, you know, $1,000 lens look. Well, I teach people how to do it for $30.
That's good. I like that. Now, you buttonholed me at a recent event and said, "Have you done anything on 3D printers?" And I have to admit that I really hadn't explored the space, but John said he basically pitched it, and it sounds like a great idea. So let's talk about 3D printers. Now, these aren't printers that print a piece of paper that you look at with 3D glasses, which some people might think.
That's true. My printer creates physical objects out of plastic, and it works very similar to a traditional printer, but instead of printing one layer of ink, I print a layer of plastic, then the printer moves up a little bit and prints another layer on top of it and just keeps going until it forms a physical object.
It's staggering what it's able to do. So it's basically just modeling out of plastic the 3D image, and the ink, as it were, you've got a broader role of it here. I want everybody at home to just imagine a big ass weed whacker.
Yep.
And exactly.
It's like the cord from the weed whackers, even rolled up. Could you use it for weed whacking?
You probably could, yeah. Yeah, you could.
It's big weeds.
We basically get spools of plastic filament. Mm-hmm. It's in a very small diameter. We feed it into a hot end that's kind of like a hot glue gun.
Yeah.
The hot glue gun is mounted on a gantry system, and it moves left, right, up, and down, and it basically draws with plastic.
And how is the plastic expelled? Is it heated to boiling point and spit out the same way as HP's inkjet technology, for example?
It's very similar. Typically, the plastic is melted down or warmed up to about 225 degrees Celsius. It's typically printed on a hot bed of metal, mm-hmm. so that it can actually maintain the chemistry as it's being built up, mm-hmm. and which is about 110 degrees. So it's a little warm as it's coming out. It kind of oozes out again like a hot glue gun, and you basically just draw with it, or the machine draws with it, and you can take a couple minutes or a few hours to print something, depending on what you're printing.
Okay, now the machine itself. Are there commercial versions of the machine available?
Well,
who makes them?
Lots of people. The technology has actually been around for about 30 years, but it's been locked away in industrial, commercial, million-dollar machines, and the patents and all that stuff like that have been around. And, people like Nike would have used it to design your running shoes, 20 years ago, that type mm-hmm. of thing. But that prototype would have cost tens of thousands of dollars to manufacture. Whereas now the technology is out of starting to come out of patents. People are finding clever ways of doing it, sort of bypassing the patents.
Okay.
And there's a number of companies like MakerBot, Ultimaker, and a few other companies that
Solidoodle. I just found.
Yeah, Solidoodle is one of the lower end ones. It's a very small little machine.
$500.
Yeah. And you can go up to a couple $1,000s depending on the size of the object you want to be able to print, and if you want to do multiple colors. All kinds of things like that.
Okay, so the pieces that come out look very much like plastic toys at the end of the day. They are definitely detailed as far as the modeling goes. And John has brought me a massive collection of stuff. It looks like it looks like a 3-year-old's shelf. At that home.
I have a workshop full of this stuff, and definitely, it does have the toy application. The mm-hmm. thing is, we're using ABS plastic primarily, and which is what your Lego is made out of. And I actually brought some Lego to show you
that you made
that I made or but printed.
Do they have issues with you making your own Lego?
Well, the patent for Lego went out in 1988, so they don't really have much to say anymore about it. Mm. And the piece you're holding right now is actually called a Tri-Lego, which Lego never actually sold, but it's the piece that everyone always wanted.
The three corners, yeah. It's a little Y shape.
So but again, making toys for your kids, this is just one application. I mean, this technology was developed for rapid prototyping, so I tried to bring a sort of a variety of sort of applications for it to show you what
he's brought.
Do
everything from little cases for hard drives that he's built himself all the way through to, I don't know what that is it a pen holder?
It's a pencil holder, or it could be art, or a paperweight, whatever you want. I got a business card holder. We've got little toys.
iPod cases you've made. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about first of all the process. What do you model in? What software do you use on your computer to make these?
There's lots of software. There's everything from commercial 3D animation packages to 3D CAD programs like AutoCAD and SolidWorks. There's a huge assortment of open source free tools that you can use to do this. And most of the stuff I play with is either Google SketchUp, which is free. I like Tinkercad.com. It's a web-based browser CAD package that you can design just with your mouse right in your browser. And then you can either send it to a 3D printing service right from the website, or you can save the file locally and print it yourself if you have a printer.
Now, I have to think that this is going to be very popular with jewelry makers and the like.
Crafting is a huge audience for this type of material because you have the ability to turn your artistic creations into physical things. There's a website that sort of we use as a sort of a warehouse of open source designs, and a lot of artists have contributed things, like thousands of things, like earrings, bracelets, objects, necklaces.
So this would work. I just so that I know the process. You could make a negative cast from this, right? You could take this plastic, you could then use it as the impression for your sand cast, which then you can make your metal cast that you're going to go as you're proceeding along to actually do cast work.
Absolutely. The big thing is it gives the ability for the user in their home or their workshop to figure out what size should it be. All the little details that normally they'd have to do with a really expensive process for building a mold and all that type of stuff. Once they figure it out, they can send that same file to that injection molding company in China and actually get their object created. Or made out of steel or mm-hmm. brass or whatever.
And they can test it all and stuff like
that. They can test it all before.
Now, what blew me away, though, when you told me what it was, I asked John about the who makes these printers, and he looked at me with the very blank expression and goes, well, I make it. You build your own printers, of course.
Well, the first printer I bought from MakerBot. I bought it last year, and it was about a $1,500 kit that you assemble yourself.
Okay.
And so it's a collection of motors, electronics, wires, and a laser-cut wooden box that you put it all together. It took about 2 days to put together. And then once it's built, well, it can print itself. So I've actually printed a second printer. About 60% of it. Of course, I didn't print the electronics and things like that. But the shell and the parts that hold it all together, I printed myself. And then now that printer has printed other printers.
You're my dad. Seriously, I have to tell you, I don't know if I've ever told this story in public before, but I bought my first house from my dad. And in the basement when I sold the house, I had to move out 3 metal lathes and a milling machine. Now, my dad had bought those over the years. My dad was an engineer. And the reason he bought it was he had a big, huge 5-foot center lathe that was missing some parts. So we bought 2 other lathes and a milling machine to make the parts for the other lathe. And I had all that in my basement. You would have liked to be me, wouldn't you?
I would have been.
Yes. I it was okay for me, but it wasn't I didn't get that excited. I wish you were me. Well, this is fascinating. Now, what about? I keep thinking, you know, as I'm going through different applications. My son has been playing this game, and I understand it's really popular. Warhammer.
Yes, it's a tabletop war game with
little figures,
and vehicles, yeah.
And they buy these figures like crazy. Could he make his own figures?
He certainly could. Yeah.
What about copyright and things like that? Are there issues around that?
Absolutely. Copyright of a physical object, like music or movies, is a very prominent issue. And there was recently someone who, like your son, played these games. He designed his own tank that was modeled after a tank that the Warhammer people sold. He put it on Thingiverse.com, which is this big warehouse with thousands of designs.
And it's not, they're just the designs. They're not actual models that you're buying, but the design to make your own model.
It's basically the blueprint to hit print on one of these printers and make your own copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
He got a cease and desist letter, and they had to remove the model because basically he could print for about 25 cents the thing that they were selling for $65. I get it. If he would have just called it a tank, he would have been okay. But he called it a specific tank that Warhammer had a trademark over. So that's part of the problem. So kind of like, you know, this is like a lot of these things are clones of things. It's really simple once you start having this technology in your hand and you understand how the software works, you'll see stuff like, wow, I could print that myself. I printed a headphone handle for my desk so I can clip my headset onto my desk. You know, you've got some nice fancy ones here, but I printed one for about 10 cents in my house, right? So when you start looking at the world through 3D printers' eyes, it changes how you work with stuff.
Replacement parts for things that are old now, for like Paul's turntables?
Yeah, there you go.
Absolutely. Well, I was at Maker Faire this past weekend, and
what's Maker Faire?
Maker Faire is it's just basically an exposition of all types of crafting people, technology, nerds, geeks, you name it, knitters.
Was it the Peony?
This was at the Peony, yep. And a good mutual friend of ours, Jillian Shaw, came by, and she had talked to me about 3D printing, and she had a real-world application. She has this winch on her boat that is about 20 years old. One little part is broken. They don't make it anymore. You'd either have to replace the winch or find a replacement part. She brought it to me. I'm like, yeah, I could model that in about 10 minutes. So I have the part right now. I haven't modeled it yet, but I can replace the part for her.
So now it's a plastic that you're modeling out of, though.
Yep.
So what happens then? She's not going to put a plastic part in her winch, is she?
It actually is a plastic part of her winch.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
wow.
It's just some little internal piece.
Now, and you can't get it anymore.
when Jillian gets stuck in Desolation Sound,
Yes.
Get the phone call.
I can give her three copies of that same part, though, too.
I guess you can. That's what this is just a whole different world. So where's the community people go to get information about this?
Well, a lot of this technology was really started by a professor in England, Adrian Boyer. He created a project called the RepRap Project. So mm-hmm. if you go to reprap.org, you can sort of read about the history of 3D printing in a DIY sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the original purpose of the project was to be a self-replicating robot that can print itself, fix itself, all that type of thing. We're not quite there yet.
Skynet.
Yes, very much so. Yes. But, and like I mentioned earlier, I can print about 60 or 70% of my printers now. And we're just looking at doing other things right now, like taking conductive plastics and printing circuit boards. Well, once we can do that, well, then the robots can print their own circuits. So, you know, you see where this is going. It does have a scary overtone, but it also has a very cool undertone of the ability to replicate and fix things autonomously.
Yeah, and it recraftifies manufacturing.
Well, there's a lot of people that are considering 3D printing to be our generation's industrial revolution or a whole new revolution period, because this really is the Star Trek future in our homes now.
Replicate stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
So, John, I need you to do a few things for me. You've got to give me a video you've got some YouTube videos, so we'll put up some videos of your printer in action, including slow-mo, I understand. And you've got to give me a little list of websites that we can post on our site.
Absolutely.
Which
you can start with my own, because I have an extensive library of posts about the process I went through building my first kit, printing my first printer with that kit, and all the trials and tribulations in between of learning how to configure it, how to calibrate it. We actually have a fairly robust local community as well of other people that are doing the same thing, and we all kind of did this in isolation. And then one guy went to a store, bought something kind of unique to 3D printing, like a very specific screw, I think it was, actually a very specific size though that's hard to find. And then like an hour later, somebody else came in and asked for the same part, and the guy at the store said, "Hey, do you know Wally? He just asked for the same part you did." And all of a sudden we started connecting people together that way. And
wow.
It's just a crazy story that I couldn't make up.
Yeah, so the 3D printing community. Art, did you have a question?
We also want a Steve Dotto bobblehead.
There you go.
That could sell.
That could be arranged.
Yeah.
Let's make it happen.
I guess you could make bobbleheads, couldn't you?
Well, the big thing about the technology, even in the last, I've only been in this for about a year. And in the last year, some huge advances in some of the software has come out, where before you needed a really expensive 3D scanner where you'd sit really still and have this laser that scans past you. Now you can literally take 40 pictures of Steve's head and create a bobblehead out of that.
Wow.
Using some software that figures out all the math and creates a 3D model from all those photos.
I think you'll need maybe like 60 pictures. Have you seen his head?
Are you saying I have a big head, Art?
No,
we
big
are
brain.
Gonna johnbeeler.com. It's johnbeeler.com is the website. We will, of course, have posts to our site. John, next time you come back in, I don't expect you to have a Steve Dotto bobblehead, but we will talk photography when you're coming back.
That sounds great.
Does that seem fair? We're going to take a quick break. I am Steve Dotto, and you're tuned in to Dotto Tech.
Dotto Tech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you. You're listening to Dotto Tech, brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.
Todd Maffin, digital guru, joins me online now from his home studio. How are you doing, Todd?
I'm good. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing just great. Let's talk today about backing up, because there's been some interesting news actually coming out of Canada, where Apple is being sued by somebody who lost a bunch of their photos because their backup system didn't work.
It's a strange thing too, because you know what the story is you're right, he took a whole bunch of photographs on his iPhone, and then he was going to sync it and so back up these photographs on one of Apple's devices, this time capsule, mm-hmm. which stores lots and lots of data and lets you roll back, so that if you decide, oh my gosh, I lost a bunch of data, I want to roll back my system to a week ago and make it look like, basically put my hard disk back in place the way it was.
It's a beautiful system. We've shown it several times. It's caught a lot of attention. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very nice, and when it works great. And there have actually, true to this guy's claim, there have been some instances where people have lost data, but that happens. Hard disks lose data. So they're not perfect. You know, everything goes bad at some point, and there's always some, you know, something where one out of a million or something will have a problem. But what he's suing them for, he's a lawyer, and he's suing them because he took the photos that were on his iPhone, and he wanted to back them up on this time capsule, time machine system. Well, and then he said, well, it didn't make it there, and or whatever happened, and in the end, I ended up without the photograph. But here's the thing that's peculiar about me, to me. Two things. One is that to do that transfer, it's very simple. Mac makes it very easy, and literally all you do is you plug your iPhone in, and it starts to back up. But it backs up to a program that Apple has called iPhoto. Mm-hmm. I think it's the I in Apple land. So it backs up to this program called iPhoto. Time Machine actually backs up iPhoto. It doesn't really back up the iPhone. So there's this intermediary step, this piece of software on your computer. So even if the time capsule, which is a physical hard drive outside of your computer, even if that crashes, he still should have all of his photographs in this iPhoto program. So it's peculiar to me that there's that sort of, well, there's a suit going on. The bigger issue, though, is this. Whenever you open up any piece of software, any piece of hardware, there is the EULA, E-U-L-A, End User License Agreement. None of us read it, and it exists on every product. And true enough, on this product, Time Capsule, when you open the box, it's got a little booklet in it, and it has all the legalese. Somewhere in that legalese, it says, as is the case with every hard disk that is made these days, essentially it says, hey, something might go wrong, this hard disk might crash, we're really sorry about it, but we take no responsibility, we can't compensate you for the data. If it's really important data, get two hard disks, you know, mm-hmm. mitigate your risks.
Redundancy.
So he's going to have to go up against that, which I think is going to be a huge issue. But I think the only thing in his favor is that there have been instances of this in the past, a little bit more in the UK, and so he might point to that. But honestly, I think this, you know, in using it, you agree, well, all right, there's a risk involved. If it's really important data, maybe I'll take a couple of extra backup steps.
And that's what I do, and I know that's what you do as well. And the you know, you've got other options as far as backing up your data than just your hard disk. And by all means, I use a Time Machine as well as other systems. So what system do you use? How do you make sure that you don't have to, that you don't lose anything that's vital?
Yeah, all of the stuff on my computer is vital to me. I make my living off of the bits and bytes that are in that computer. So it's absolutely critical. So I have three backup systems running almost all the time. The first, and I think is the most important for people to use, and in some cases is free as well, incidentally, is a cloud backup system. Cloud, as you know, is like the internet. And so it's instead of what we used to do is we used to back up things to floppy disks, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or else we'd copy them onto
tape backups. I used to demonstrate tape backups that would do incremental backups on a tape. Back in the day,
zip drives were like that.
Zip drives as well.
So we had all these devices, and they worked great. They were a little slow, but they relied on you, as you just said. They relied on you taking a step to do something, right? Making an incremental backup, or remembering once a week. We all had these little post-it notes. You know, once a week, I better back up my computer. And you know, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. So what if there were a way where your computer is just always backing up? Mm-hmm. That's what these cloud systems do. Every time you make a change to one of your files that's in this backup area, it just automatically backs it up. And where does it go? It goes to a number of different computer servers, mostly in the US, but there's a few all over the world, and it stores it there securely. So no one can get in. People can't just log in and see your data. In fact, these companies who have the cloud data say that they can't. Their main tech support people can't even get in to see your data. So that's great because you don't have to think about it. It kind of protects us against ourselves, right? So you literally just save your data, and it gets backed up somewhere else as well. So you still have it on your computer. But yep. it's just a backup. There's a number of these services. Dropbox is the one that I use. I find that to just be smoothest of all of them. And in the event your computer goes to hell in a handbasket, you can either just download the data again, or they'll even cut you a DVD of your data and mail it to you.
Yeah, if it's been backed up. Yeah.
Yeah, which is really, really cool.
A mirror
of
your
drive. Competitor, there's a number of competitors to Dropbox, but the new competitor is free, and it's by Google, and it's called Google Drive. And it basically does the same thing. But here, Steve, this is where I think people are sort of missing the boat on using these services. So if you use Google Drive or Dropbox or any of these services, what they'll do is they'll create a new folder in your documents folder. You know, we have like My Documents or documents on your computer, and that's where you throw all of your Word documents and your Excel spreadsheets and blah, blah, blah. Well, Dropbox and Google Drive both create their own folder in there. So the only thing that gets backed up are things that are in that folder. So if you haven't moved all of your documents, or at least the documents that you find critical, into that folder, they're not going to be backed up. So what I did was I got a lot of storage. Dropbox gives you a little bit of storage for free, and then you can pay annually.
Yeah, I think you get 2 gigabytes for free, and then if you get friends to sign up, you get an extra 250 megabytes up to a certain limit, but then you can purchase it for $10 or $15 a month for additional.
And it's completely reasonable if it's mission-critical stuff.
Yep.
So what I did was I moved all of my documents, all of them, into that Dropbox folder. Mm-hmm. So there's not a single document that is not in that folder of mine. Everything that's important, I move there. So that way I know everything's going to be done. So Google Drive, you do the same thing. You move all of your, once Google Drive is hooked up and working, you move all of your documents out of Google Drive and you put them out of your My Documents folder and you put them into Google Drive.
And so all of these services have a free to start program where they give you a certain amount of storage for free so you can test it out, try it out, and get comfortable with it. And in some people's case, it's enough backup for free.
Google's is most generous with that. You're right. Google gives you a lot of storage space.
I think.
And when you want to buy more storage space, it's considerably cheaper to buy more with Google than it is with Dropbox.
Yes.
So a lot of people are using now. I just started with Dropbox, and I love them, and that's why I've.
Well, Dropbox has some really nice hooks into other systems, and Dropbox has been around so long. And for the longest time, Dropbox was the only way to efficiently get large files or things into your iPad and be able to back them up from your iPad. So if you were working on any collaborative documents and you wanted them on your iPad or presentations. I give a lot of my keynote presentations from my iPad. Dropbox was the only way to get it in for a period of time, other than emailing it, which was not really too user friendly.
Yeah.
So that was the option. You know, the other really useful thing about a tool like Dropbox is increasingly as we have a lot of large files and large photographs that we take, sharing them with our friends and family, or even little videos we create, is much easier using Dropbox because you can create shared folders within Dropbox, which allow you to transfer large files that you then don't have to embed in emails, because some people have email limits as far as how large a file they can send back and forth. So that's another feature that I really like in Dropbox.
I love that. And it's really cool, actually, to use, because I've got my assistant is in Toronto. And so whenever she does something, like she's putting folders or she's putting documents in a folder, like a contract gets signed, so she puts it onto my hard disk, all she does is she drags it into her Dropbox folder. So she and I have the same folders,
yep.
And they're replicated. Yep. So the second she drops something in the folder on her computer, remember, she's in Toronto, a little notification pops up on my screen saying, such and such a document has been added to your folder on your computer as well. That's really slick. So
and
Dropbox is great.
Have you noticed an additional feature in Dropbox, which with your iPhone, as I come home, as soon as my iPhone has new photographs, Dropbox notices the new photographs, and it offered me that, which this lawyer should probably pay attention to, it offers me the ability to back up all my photos onto Dropbox as well. So I say yes, because I've got tons of Dropbox space, and I want as much redundancy as possible in case anything happens.
And some people out there who are listening probably use iPhoto or maybe Aputure, which is sort of like iPhoto Pro.
Yep.
And so those photographs get logged in that program as well. What I've done is I've taken that iPhoto library. It stores all of your photographs, this program. iPhoto is a photo management, so you can put them in their own little folders and edit them, things like that. And it stores all of your photographs in one big file. Well, I've moved that one big file into my Dropbox folder. So, and now that's backed up too. Everything on my computer, every document. I should say, if you really want to be super, super, super protected and not worry about moving things into your Dropbox or Google Drive folder and have it completely, there are other systems out there that will back up literally almost your whole hard drive.
Yes.
Even stuff you don't need to back up, like applications that you can install again. And there's a myriad of those as well. Backblaze is the one that I used. The downside with those is that they don't use bandwidth very well. Bandwidth is the amount of data that comes into your computer at home or at the office. And because they're backing up enormous amounts of data all the time, it slows down your system. So you will notice that your websites that you're trying to get to load slower. If you use Skype, suddenly your grandmother starts talking like it's at it's very well, you know, you get that kind of funny
that
robot
attenuation. Yeah.
So Dropbox is my number one, and I have two other. Do you want to hear the other two? I have two other.
Because I've got two other ones as well. Which are the other two that you have?
A big, huge hard disk that's really tiny. You can get these 2 terabyte, which is an enormous amount of space.
Yep.
2 terabyte hard drives for about the size of less than 2 packs of playing cards put side by side. And I literally just every 3 or 4 weeks plug it in, back up everything, which takes a couple of hours. And here's the key to that. You take that hard disk and you put it off-site somewhere. Because if your house burns down, all the backups in the world there aren't going to help you, right? So you leave that off-site. And that's kind of nice as well. And there's some great programs that will, instead of you having to drag every folder over manually, there are great programs out there. Look for backup mirroring. And mirroring meaning they'll make like a mirror image. It'll be literally an identical copy on that external hard drive. So identical, in fact, that you can boot from it. You could, even if the hard disk in your computer is completely dead, won't spin up, won't do anything, sparks fly out of it when you try, you can plug in this hard disk and you can boot or start your computer from there. Mm-hmm. That's really important. And then the third one that I use is, in fact, Time Machine. I've never had any problems with it. I like the fact that it's on site, that it's just, again, it's always working. You don't have to think about it. I like, so those are my three. And I think if you at least have two backup systems, if you're nerdy like you and I, I have like as many as possible.
I don't use the mirroring. I use Time Machine. I use Dropbox for all of my folders. And then I use one called SugarSync, which is very nice, which basically syncs all of my different computers. And the benefit of SugarSync is my notebook and my desktop have the same documents folder because SugarSync manages that between the two of them. So even if I'm not online, I can get to all my documents if I'm in my notebook. If I was just working on a word processing file and now I'm on a plane and I forgot to, you know, and you, of course, don't have an internet connection at that point, it syncs all of my documents folders across my different devices. So that's the one that I use for that. And
that's very cool.
It is cool.
And, you know, it's interesting because increasingly we are using devices in different places. It used to be that you'd have one computer at the office, so you didn't have to sync anything. Well, now we've all got a computer at home. Many of us have got a device like an Android phone or an iPhone or whatever. And so we kind of, all this syncing is beginning to really pick up.
Todd, I think we better call it at this point. Todd Maffin is a public speaker. He does a lot of blogging and writing, training. You can find his site at toddmaffin.com. Of course, he is a social media guru. He is the man I turn to when I have questions about what's happening in the social media world. Todd, thanks a lot for your time today.
Anytime, Steve.
Dottotech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe
you.
The
world of Apple. So what's up, Rick?
A little bit of video here, I think. Yeah.
The iPhone 4S is a fine video camera.
That's what I hear. I still have the iPhone 4.
Me too. But it still does a pretty good job on video.
It does. I've seen some comparisons with like the Canon 5 Mark II, I think.
Okay.
It's quite comparable. And this is a camera phone.
Yeah.
Whoever thought that would happen? Wasn't that long ago that people were wondering why you need a camera on your phone at all?
Yeah. Well, it's become the camera. When I travel, I was just down in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago, and I was shooting all my pictures, and I took videos down there of all the bands. And you know what surprised me was how good the audio was on the that I picked up. Yeah, it was really quite good.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. Well, I've got a few bizarre video apps.
Okay.
I've got a social video app. I've got one for animation. And then to just wrap up the serious video apps on the iPad. Mainly.
Okay.
Okay, so to start off with...
So we're looking at the mobility ones. We're not looking at ones for your Mac, the Pro ones. These are ones for our iOS devices.
Exactly, yeah. Good. There's one called Action Movie FX.
Mm-hmm.
It's a free one. It's made by J.J. Abrams.
The TV guy.
The TV guy. The guy who made Lost and did the recent Star Trek reboot. And what it does is it grafts some really realistic looking kind of action movie effects, basically. You can have these cars cutting into the frame and smashing into each other. These machine guns start firing.
And I've seen people playing with these, and you can make people blow up. You can take a picture of a person and make them blow up and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it seems to follow the motion of the video you take. So it doesn't just seem to be overlaid. It actually follows the kind of natural movement of the camera as you hold it.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks pretty convincing, and if you have an Apple TV as I do, and you use AirPlay to show these to people. I showed did one of these just sitting in Starbucks, videotaping the cars drive by outside, and then suddenly this other car comes from over my head and bounces into the parking lot and bounces away, and it shocks people.
And it's free.
It's totally free.
Okay.
It has some in-app purchases where you can buy some other effects, but it's fun to play around with, and of course you can share all these videos. They're very short.
Yeah.
And you can share them various places.
Got it. Okay, so that's Action Movie FX.
FX. Then the other one I wanted to share with you is called Kinotopic.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one I encourage you to look for it online, because it's pretty difficult to explain. What they say are kinos, which are the little videos that this produces, also known as cinemagraphs, are still photographs in which a minor and repeating movement occurs.
Okay.
Kinotopic is an easy way to use your iPhone to capture kinos and share them online. Now, the kind of creepy one that I did myself was to show myself from the side, and then beyond me was a mirror, and what I was able to do was make it look like I have not turned my head at all, but my reflection turns around and looks at myself.
Got it.
So you can isolate a certain part of the scene and make that move while the rest stays perfectly still.
So you do it by taking two pictures.
You take
a picture and a video.
You take a full video, mm-hmm. You choose one frame of that video, and then you tell the app what part of that still frame you want to kind of cut a hole in and let the video show through.
Got it. Oh, that looks really cool. Yeah, so that's that does. That's kind of freaky, having the still picture. They've got some samples on their website. So Kinopic.
Kinotopic.
Kinotopic. Yeah. It would
very
make
cool.
A really nice little video on a website as a part of a, you know, almost like an animated logo.
Yeah,
that would be unique. Yeah,
kind of harkens back to the animated GIFs in the forums that people would post.
Yeah, like almost avatarish. Got it.
Yeah, the social video one I wanted to talk about, and I know you're not a huge fan of Instagram.
Yeah, I like Instagram. I like it a lot less at $1 billion, but go ahead.
Well, thankfully they don't charge you that on the App Store.
Yeah,
Social Cam is a free app that does for video what Instagram does for still pictures. So you can take your little video of any length, they say. Well, there's always a limit. And then you apply custom filters. The videos are stored on the cloud and are viewable on any device, even though you make them on the iPhone.
Now, is this similar to Vidi?
I haven't really checked into Vidi, but I think it sounds similar.
Yeah.
Similar to a lot of the video sharing ones.
Okay.
This one seems to be the one that's taking off. Gary Vaynerchuk and a few of the social gurus are latching onto this one.
Okay.
So you can share on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube,
Social
email.
Cam. Little videos. Yes.
Yeah. To get into animation, this one you get to use your iPad and your iPhone together.
Okay.
So for $10, you buy iStop Motion by Boink Software for your iPad. Then you get the free remote camera for your iPhone, and the iPad serves as the director, while the iPhone serves as the cameraman.
Okay.
And if you're not familiar with what stop motion is, basically, it's moving three-dimensional objects instead of like cell animation where they're flat. You can take like a little action figure and move it, arms and legs just slightly, take one frame, move them again just slightly, another frame. Yeah.
You can have lots of fun. You can do it with Lego or any of those sorts of things. Or a Gumby. Gumby and Pokey.
Gumby and Pokey would be perfect because that's where they started.
Now, they have a desktop app available on their site also for $50. So this is a nice, simple way to get into it for $10.
Exactly. And if you have a way to kind of lock down your iPhone so that it's sturdy and you don't have to touch the iPhone at all.
Yeah.
You take the pictures on remote controlled from the iPad.
That's good. And then you move the subject in front, but you can also see it and you can frame it so the iPad gives you all the context you need to measure your motion and all that sort of stuff. That sounds like, you know where this would be outstanding? This would be outstanding in schools as an education app.
Very much so.
Yeah, I like that. I like that one. I'm going to play with that.
Then we get to even more serious stuff. And, I mean, when you're talking about the iPad, you are limited in what you can do. So in that case, iMovie is serious stuff. It's $5. You can create movie trailers. Unfortunately, I don't think you could really make the movie in the end, but you can promise a movie and not follow through with it. It edits at 1080p, but it disappoints me in that you can't share your movies to iMovie on the desktop and finish them up. I think that was a weak spot.
Yeah, the iOS apps all have limitations.
Yes,
and iMovie is probably, if you've played with Keynote on any of the iOS devices or even Pages or the others, you get the feel for what sort of limitations you're going to have.
Yeah, you do feel a little hamstrung.
Yeah. Okay.
Avid Studio also $5, but has really nice composite effects. You can do picture in picture, so you could do what they call the lower thirds, where you have the little banner with the person's name down there, and you can bring in your own graphics and do those kind of effects. Really good titles. Only edits 720p, but I'm not picky.
Nope, that's good enough.
That's pretty good.
You're on a small device. Come on.
Exactly. And it doesn't do any themes. It doesn't do any voiceover, but it shares to YouTube and Facebook. Can send over email, of course. It's a pretty solid video app, and I've been tempted in the last little while to go totally iPad and just see how long I could go without picking up my laptop. And video is the one thing that kind of keeps me from breaking loose and just going iPad only. But I think with Avid Studio and maybe Real Director, which is only $2, which also allows you to zoom in on video, crop, has tons of transition, does allow for voiceover, has really great titles. Like, you can do really good text effects in it. Also 720p. If I could get Real Director, Avid Studio, and probably a little bit of iMovie, I might be able to do my videos on it.
So you're going to spend a grand total of $12 on your video editing apps, and you're gonna turf the notebook for $12.
Yeah, turf the notebook. I spent thousands of dollars on, hundreds of dollars on video editing software.
And you can do the preponderance of it for $12.
Yes,
that's crazy. But that's, you know what? That's why we are in the post PC revolution, sir.
Yes, it is.
For all of these sites and apps, we are going to post them on our website. And for more information from Rick Yeager, appman.tv. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Theo Horstall joins me, the technology buyer at London Drugs. How are you doing, Theo?
I'm very good, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Now, I hear through the grapevine that you've bought yourself a new house, that you're moving.
Yeah, I am. It's actually happening in just a couple of days.
Okay. Now, I am also selling a house, and it's an interesting timing because I've just done a series of talks to a bunch of realty boards talking about the technology that they should be using. And some realtors are completely on top of technology and some aren't. Now, I heard through the grapevine that you did a lot of your documentation and signing your contract actually on your iPad. Is that true?
It is, as a matter of fact. I never saw a single piece of paper other than the printout of the original internet, the internet listing for the house. Everything else from that point on, up to the point of where you have to sign notary paperwork or whatnot, was all done electronically.
isn't that great. Now, the one piece of technology we need for this, obviously you need a tablet computer and you've got an iPad. You need one of those styluses, those $14 styluses, in order to do it properly.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think if anybody's tried to finger paint their signature onto even a piece of paper with paint, it's just not, it's not possible.
Not quite the same. Well, and, you know, and what surprises me is some in the real estate market, and I'm sure other markets are like this, some realtors are oblivious to the fact that they can do these things. I was sitting in a Starbucks on my way to a concert, my daughter's concert, and we had some paperwork that we had to do. And the my realtor is going, oh, well, just when you get to home, I'll fax it to you. Now, I don't even have a fax machine at home. And so I go, no, just email it to me. And he goes, oh, okay. And he emailed me this document. I just opened it in a PDF annotation program, which is what I'm sure you used. Mine was iAnnotate, I think. I signed off the document, then emailed it right back to him, and he goes, well, did you fax that? I said, no, I signed it on my iPad. And he wasn't sure it was legal, but I assured him it was, because I'm an expert, of course. But
go ahead, sorry.
And it was just, but it surprised me that, you know, some obviously are right on top of it, but others are kind of a little bit behind the curve there.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was actually quite surprised. It was actually just by coincidence that we were sitting at the table in my real estate, and she pulled out her iPad and showed me the documents. And she said, "Yeah, I can do this all electronically." It was actually a program that she was using that allowed me to pick my digital signature, which, you know, I could select five or six different ones, and then proceed to go through, and wherever I noted, clicked on the document, it would actually digitally sign that document. And then, of course, as you mentioned, I needed a stylus to actually physically write out my name on one document. Other than that, it was great. So back and forth by email.
All electronic.
We did the whole thing electronically. Yeah.
Well, the whole concept, I'm back at school and I'm working on my master's now, and I'm bound and determined from day one of this new educational venture I'm on not to print a single piece of paper. I don't know if I'm going to make it through the whole master's, but I'm through my first courses, and I did it with them all on the iPad and the computer. Never
wow,
once printing a page.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not getting good marks, but I don't think that has anything to do with the technology.
Well, you know, and the whole irony, as I mentioned, up to a certain point, so the where I can say that it's absolutely not electronic is when you go to, you know, to make actually the payments and sign the documents with either a notary or a lawyer.
Yeah.
I think I literally was responsible for killing a couple of trees. The amount of paperwork involved with that, everything has to be signed twice, and, of course, copies to everybody. Absolutely incredible how non-electronic that process is. So
yeah, but we're
so
getting
I think you know, I think
the
topic maybe of what you originally brought up is when you if you need the services of a real estate agent, maybe you should ask them A, if they're using electronic, and B, if they're still using a fax machine. If they're using a fax machine, they're probably not on top of a lot of different things that are going on.
But can they sell the house? That's the end.
Well, there you go. Absolutely. I can't comment on that.
Theo Horsdahl is with London Drugs. Thanks for your time, Theo.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Well, Art, that is all the time we have for this week's show. It has flown by, and I didn't even get a chance to tell people about our new Uber Cool giveaway that we're having on the website this month. Guess what it is? You'll never guess.
I'll never guess.
Well, you can look at it and guess. It is a Presso espresso machine. It's not high tech. But it is sort of high-tech. But see, coffee is the fuel of the high-tech universe.
Oh.
So it really fits. So
it's like gas for geeks.
It's gas for geeks. There you go. I think we'll change the title, Gas for Geeks. Drop by our website, enter to win. We will see you again next time right here on Dotto Tech. I'm Steve Dotto. Thanks for tuning in.
Dotto Tech is brought to you in part by London Drugs. Nobody does it better, except maybe you.